This week, Otto Preminger crosses the Alps from Vienna to Rome to continue filming The Cardinal. And man moves up that long pyramid of infinity, ever reaching toward Parnassus. Right now, at this very minute, Otto Preminger is crossing the Alps, as great men before him have crossed the Alps, from Vienna to Rome, to continue filming The Cardinal. Oh, Hannibal! Oh, Alexander the Great! Oh, mankind! Oh, that was what a way to start the week. Reset that, please. Don't lose that. Hello. You got the gain turned up here? Am I still on? Hello. There. Bring me up a little bit. Hello. I'm going to fade out. Hey. Wait, before you cue that up, bring my mic up. Hello. Oh, it's all right. Hello. Hello. Oh, excuse me, sir. Hey, tell him not to cue it up. We don't need it. There, that's better. Oh, hello. Bring my game. I think I'm way down here. Hello. Oh, is this okay? I guess so. I don't know. Then what's the matter? Is our monitor off, too, in addition to the transmitter? No, I know all about that. I've been in the studio since 1932, so I know about that. There, now we're coming back up. There, that's very good. You know, it's funny. That ad, I think, is one of the most magnificent examples of almost everything in our world today. There is no question about it, but that every author who writes believes that he has a stranglehold on TRUTHEEE. And everybody who's doing anything is doing something unbelievably important, especially if it's involved in the world of entertainment or even remotely connected with art at all. And even guys who are smoking pot are making an intellectual adventure now. In fact, there's an article recently that came out about a well-known drug that'll knock you right out of your skull if you try it. And of course, you see, the thing about our time is nothing, we can't do anything without admitting what we're doing. We just can't anymore. We cannot. If seven guys are having a fist fight around the big table in Geneva, and everyone knows it's a fist fight, they gotta pretend that they are probing the exigencies toward bringing about a permanent state of quiescent peace among the peoples of the world, especially the struggling masses. Well, what they're doing is hollering at each other. And getting nowhere, of course. and so everywhere you find this gigantic rationalization going on. Of course, sometimes it reaches almost unbelievably cosmic humorous heights. For example, this ad. Can I just keep that there in abeyance now? You got it queued up? What a fantastic ad. I'll read this to you again. This is the entire ad. And, oh, the ad, if you haven't seen the ad shows a gigantic expanse of sky. Now see it yourself. Now you see it. It's a picture and it shows the sky. And the sky is about three quarters of the ad. Just a tremendous expanse. It's like infinity, you know. Somehow heaven is there off in the distance someplace. Probably the giant golden throne itself and the pearly gates, which Mr. Preminger is about to occupy. No doubt he's going to do some filming there. But nevertheless, there you see the sky. And below the sky, you see like an enormous sea, just wave upon wave upon wave after wave after wave, the ancient, time immemorial snow-covered Alps. And above the Alps, hanging there in the sky, is the simple declaration. This week, Otto Preminger crosses the Alps from Vienna to Rome to continue filming The Cardinal. Oh, boy, what an ego. It'll probably turn out to be another one of these gigantic Technicolor four-panel, three-and-a-half-hour turkeys, which Mr. Preminger is so adept in turning out. I don't know. Do you become adept at turning out bad things? I guess that is a certain amount of adeptness there. Stop to consider. It ain't easy to hit mediocrity so consistently. Once more, hit it again. This week, Otto Preminger crosses the Alps from Vienna to Rome to continue filming The Cardinal. Can't you see those elephants going? The wind howling down out of the Alps, and they're leading in the forefront, Mr. Preminger with his megaphone. Onward, onward to Rome, onward to the Vatican. I got to admire him. By George. And that, I think, is probably as typical, or perhaps even as symbolic, better than typical, symbolic of the movie industry entirely. Have you ever watched the Academy Awards? Every rotten little picture and every little thing that's done, of course, it's greeted with giant fanfare, and everybody walks and wears their $400 dresses and their $200 tuxedos and their $75 cummerbunds. And it begins to have, somehow you just can't help but like it, you know? All the jazzmatazz. You know, speaking of that, and the Otto Preminger syndrome, it is quite true, I'm sure, that around the Preminger set right now, where they're filming The Cardinal, that Mr. Preminger and Pope John have a great deal in common. And as a matter of fact, I imagine there's a lot of doubt as to whom ranks who here. This week, Otto Preminger crosses the Alps from Vienna to Rome to continue filming The Cardinal. Next week, he parts the Red Sea and changes water into wine. Be sure to see it at your neighborhood theater. Free parking provided for our patrons. Hey, George, there's a man. Oh, hey, George. you know, I'm sort of a spy in a way. I wonder where you sign up. I really do. I'm serious about that. I would like to know where you sign up. I've known several people who worked in offices of great men. And when I say great men, I'm talking about the kind of guy with, of course, one thing about most great men of our time, they are notable almost exclusively for the monstrous quality of the things they turn out. Now, no great man would ever say, paint a miniature, ever. No great man has ever been known to write a quatrain. No great man writes couplets. Certainly we know that for a fact, don't we? And no great movie maker ever makes 16-millimeter, 22-minute shorties. This is in a pig's ear. And everything has to be done on an enormous scale. Now that is a thing which has been observed and has been followed by many artists within the past two or three years. For example, I went to a show here a couple of weeks ago. An artist they sent me the thing. I'm always getting harassed by people who are having shows, so I went to the show. And the problem with the show was that they didn't have walls big enough for these paintings. No, they didn't really. So what they did, they had to set up special racks in the middle of the floor that were longer than the walls, that stretched out into the halls. And this guy had gigantic paintings. Now, if you have nothing to say, and if you really can't say it very well, what you do have to say, the thing to do is to get a 500-watt amplifier to say it through. And then you produce the... at truth with a wide sweeping brush.
lashing angrily at 40-foot canvases, he lays it out. Yes, Clarence Seastrom, our new discovery, probes into the very innermost recesses of man's fast retreating conscience. And with great splashing swirls of red and green and orange and yellow and purple, he says it. My God, he says it. 42 feet long, 17 feet high.
Yeah, well, it scared me a little bit there. Why don't you use that one, too? Bring the next one on. I'll give you the next one. I'll give you a cue on that. So Mr. Preminger is crossing the Alps from Vienna to Rome to continue filming the Cardinal. Well, the other day, it's been about a week or two ago, by some mistake, I was invited to a wild scene. And I got telegrams, and I was receiving letters. And as I say, I will function now. Let's make a pact. I will function as your spy. Now, I know a lot of people, for one reason or another, don't get invited to these ridiculous extravaganzas. Now, I'm going to be the first to tell you, you are lucky. You are missing nothing. But what you are missing is perhaps an insight or a peep into the greatest carnival that the world will ever know. I'm sure we can't top ourselves. Oh, maybe we can. I don't know. We're topping Rome. Matter of fact, speaking of Rome, I'm invited to this thing, see, and it comes, and it's a tremendous scroll. Comes in a scroll. Now, when you get invited to something and it comes in a scroll with a seal on it and with a piece of melted wax on the bottom of it that has the imprint of the Caesars, you really don't push it, you just don't throw it down there with the stuff from the home loan company and the things that you're constantly getting from Look magazine about now it's time to sign up. You don't throw that stuff away. So I get this scroll and I open the scroll up and it says, now I think it's time to bring up a little you have been designated to witness the showing of the lovely gowns especially created for Elizabeth Taylor in her performance, which is magnificent and probably will all the Academy Awards from here until doomsday, the most magnificent performance in the most magnificent motion picture ever made in that magnificent place called Hollywood, filmed on the magnificent banks of the Nile, that magnificent age-old story of love, beauty, death, transfiguration, God, life, and all the weeping eternal tears of mankind. Cleopatra! Da, 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 da. Free drinks served in the foyer. Well, the scroll was 3.5 feet long, and it was on genuine Egyptian papyrus. And it rattled and squeaked when I opened it up. I could smell the graves of all the ancient pharaohs come and a few other things. There was a strong odor of pastrami about it, too. But I unrolled this thing, and there it was. I was invited to the home of all the Caesars, Cleopatra herself. Fantastic orgy will take place aboard the Italian liner Cristoforo Colombo. Italiano Romissimo. Bella donna Milano. Giulia Cesarissimo. Benito Mussolini. Belluce, Belluce. Let me tell you, it was scary. When you get an invitation like that, I was invited once to Esther Jane Albury's 9th birthday, and they did it by sending me an actual little candy cake. Here's a little cake, that came and had a little candle on it, and it came in a little box, and it was a candy cake that was especially made to invite you to a birthday. And it said on the outside, Esther Jane invites you, and then it was a little blank, see, Jean, misspelled, of course, to her ninth birthday, which will be held May 25th. Please bring present. Well, now, speaking of loaded invitations, this is WOR AM and FMsville, New York. And if you can't hear us tonight, it's because we've got the transmitter turned off. We're cooling off the tubes there. And a lot of other things are going on. We have with us tonight Random House. No, that's all right. You don't want to play that. I'll give that one live. I'll do it live here. And it's about Jules Feiffer's new book called Hold Me, which is it's a very well-named book. As a matter of fact, Jules himself says, you know, this is a... I saw Jules the other day at the Tony Awards. I'm going to start dropping names. Kilgallen can do it. Frank Farrell can do it. I'm going to drop names. I'll tell you about the time I was in Calumet City, Illinois, and I met this guy named Homer Hegwisch. You want to hear that story? It was in a bar called... Oh, well, you don't want to hear about the Ivanhoe Bar and that night. Oy, oy, oy. Well, anyway, this book is called Hold Me. And Jules himself is the first to tell you it's a very nervous book, and it's about the inability of people to make the scene. And it's a very funny book. And it's Random House, and it's now on sale now. It's available at your friendly neighborhood Random House dealer. It's $1.95. It's called Hold Me. It's the first book out this year that sweats. Okay? All right. Now, the book sweats, and it also has bad teeth. But outside of that, it's a very good book. But, well, you want to hear what happened? The boy, the Cristoforo Colombo, bellissimo del Duce. Oh, you want to hear that? Well, I'll tell you, I got aboard this thing. See, I sneak aboard these things to see what's going on. So that when the time comes when, you know, I'm up in my dotage and people are plucking at my elbows and they say, you really remember the 60s? I mean, you know, it's like when I was, you know, when I got hung, it's funny, right after the war, I'm in school, see, and everybody at that point suddenly got hung on the 1920s. Everybody was reading about Fitzgerald. You know, Fitzgerald had a gigantic vogue, and everybody was playing Neo-Dixieland and stuff and talking about it. Well, so I would go home on the weekends, Al, and I would pluck at my mother's elbow and say, hey, Ma, you mean to tell me you actually were a flapper? Do you remember the 20s, Ma? And she would look at me like I'm a nut, you know? She'd say, well, yeah, I remember the 20s. And I'd say, well, Ma, how was it like to be around and you know, did anybody make any bathtub gin in your neighborhood? What are you talking about? I said, well, did anybody make any bathtub tin? Did you holler hot cha? Did you holler hot cha? And did dad come around with a ukulele? She said, do you mean to tell me, did your old man come around with a ukulele? Did we holler hot cha? What do you, I said, no, Ma, did you holler hot cha? I mean, now, for example, now here, let's take F. Scott Fitzgerald. Were you part of the forgotten generation, Ma? The forgotten generation? I said, well, Ma, were you flaming youth? Oh, I see what you mean. Did we swing? I said, well, yeah, I guess. She says, what have you been reading? Have you been getting into my bottom drawer again? Well, the point being here that I'm preparing, you see, so that when people pluck at my elbow 150 years from now and say, do you really remember the 60s? What do you remember about them? Wow. You mean you actually went to Michael Todd's birthday party in the Madison Square Garden? I say, yep, I did, son. Well, I did. I'm going to tell you about, you know, that's funny how we erase the really meaningful things of our time. One of the truly, I think, monumental examples of the here and now was the gigantic Michael Todd fiasco at Madison Square Garden. I will never forget the sight of the 12th Street Lancers, or whatever that gang of juvenile delinquents were, breaking into Madison Square Garden and running around down on the floor. And I'm up there sitting, oh, yeah, you didn't hear about all this. And they're running around on the floor stealing the door prizes. I saw one kid that had a thing on the back that said 14th Street AC on this purple satin jacket carrying an outboard motor right out the side door. And all the while, Ben Grauer is sort of wandering around after him with a big balloon on the end of a thing and eating a piece of pink cake. And Elizabeth Taylor is wading knee-deep in purple icing up on top. They're cutting a gigantic cake and throwing it down at all the dowagers who were running after each other looking for little plastic balloons that were souvenirs of Around the World in 80 Days. I will never forget the sight. It tells more about, yes, oh yes. And the waiters were running up and down the aisle selling champagne at $10 a bottle. It was supposed to be free. Oh boy. But that was just one thing. I am here in the Cristoforo Colombo the other day. It's a fine ship, see, and I'm walking around the ship, which is why I really wanted to go. But I also wanted to see what was going to happen. Well, finally, the time arrived, and it is now 3:30 when the big event was about to occur. They are going to demonstrate and to model with genuine Elizabeth Taylor-type models. They are going to model the unbelievably pretentious, the unbelievably badly designed gowns that Elizabeth Taylor is wearing in this turkey, this forthcoming fiasco. Well, we're all sitting in there, and there is a—I don't know. This has never really been properly documented. As you're a spy, I'm going to report on something you perhaps don't know. There is a group of people in New York, and I don't think you find it in any other city because New York makes a genuine business of this sort of thing. It does not exist in Cleveland, I can tell you that, because there wouldn't be enough business for them there. And it doesn't exist in Chicago, but it probably will when Chicago discovers showbiz, the way we've discovered showbiz in New York. And showbiz becomes a religion. Remember, showbiz is more of a religion here in New York than it is actually theater or the movies or anything else. It has all kinds of connotations. I tell you this, that I can get on the air here and I can make all kinds of rotten remarks about, the devil and God and get no angry phone calls. If I said one rotten thing about Tony Martin, the Bronx would boil over. I'll tell you, Staten Island would develop a rash that wouldn't stop until next Wednesday. I don't know why. It's just that way. So you begin to realize who the real gods and goddesses are in this world. They have little to do with the good book. Unless they happen to play characters in the good book occasionally in gigantic epics like Charlton Heston. Now he's becoming interchangeable. It's very difficult. I'm sure that many a person today, when he begins to feel himself going down the great coal chute, the eternal tunnel of love into Never Never Land, expects to see Charlton Heston at the other end, waiting there, with great big billowing white clouds behind him and Mantovani strings going, all in stereo. I'm sure that he's expecting that, we can never consider anything like that without romance. So there has to be somebody in the form of perhaps an archangel, maybe Audrey Hepburn, making a few eyes at God, and God is resisting the temptation to get about the business with maintaining decorum in heaven. But that's beside the point when we get ourselves involved in the Cristoforo Colombo. I get aboard this ship, and the minute you're on a ship, you know, you're aware of this. I don't know whether you've been recently on a ship, but it's even true to a certain extent in airplanes. But airplanes have a certain mindless, personalityless quality about them. They are really machines. It is hard to become attached to, say, a DC-8. It is truly hard to feel as though you're at home when you step aboard the 707. It's a machine. It really is. It's about as impersonal as the average quarter, 25-cent piece. It's very difficult to feel that this is my quarter. This nickel is mine. It's beautiful and it's mine. No, it's very hard to do this because they are truly machines. Whereas ships still have about them the nuttiness of a previous period. The nuttiness, in this case, consisting of the impractical, however, the aesthetically pleasing. There is very little of the impractical about an airplane. The pleasing quality of an airplane is perhaps in a negative sense. It is a pure hiding the machine quality instead of being a positive step of beauty. You follow me there? And another thing, too, about the machine is that almost everything that's done around an airplane, or a machine for that matter, is done in a sense to depersonalize it and to de-sexize it and to denationalize it. It is a machine. In fact, the machine itself today, I would suggest, is a separate nationality. It is in reality a separate race that has its own aesthetics. It has its own morality. its own standards of behavior and so on. So naturally, there can't be really an Italian airplane or a British airplane. A lot of people would pretend that this is so. They would say, oh, why, what do you mean? Well, it's a DC-7, I'm sorry, or it's a 707. And then you get aboard, say, an Italian airplane or a French airplane, and about all they can do to make it French or Italian is to hang a French painting, perhaps, at the end, and put a couple of French stewardesses in there and give you lukewarm wine. As far as Italian is concerned, they put a couple of Italian girls in there, and maybe then they'll put an Italian Renaissance painting hanging at the end. That's about it. That's about all you can do. It's an airplane, you know? They can't have... Now, I would tell you, it would be different if you were to get aboard an airplane. Let's say an Italian airplane, and you were to get in there, and suddenly you were confronted with the spectacle of, instead of airplane seats, they have giant gilt thrones with carved gargoyles and birds all over it, and they're gilt, you see, and great big red plush cushions sticking out with a sort of musty smell of like 10,000 years of history behind them, and some moths sitting, flying out, and above each seat it says, please do not sit, only look. This is a genuine antique, because that's the way all of Italy is. You can't sit on anything. And you stand up all the way and have an argument. You have an argument all the way from Idlewild to Napoli, or perhaps Champignon Romano. You have an argument all the way about a mistake in your ticket. Now, that would be truly getting aboard an Italian airplane. But believe me. And then when you order something, you get everything opposite. You look on the menu, you order the Rigoletto un musetta sarsurino, and you order it, and it comes and it's cold cuts. And you try to explain to him, and the guy doesn't understand, you don't understand, you yell and holler, you get purple, and you eat the cold cuts. Well, that would be really Italy. But they'll never have a plane like this. It would be great. You know, but this is... And so when you hear this stuff about you're getting aboard and you're suddenly in Italy, forget it. You're suddenly in the Douglas plant, is where you really are. You are not in it. you are just not there. Now, I can imagine other ones, too. For example, if you were to get aboard an English plane, now you get aboard the English plane, say, and nobody talks to you. In fact, it would be impossible to get the steward to even look at you if you were aboard truly an English plane. You would say, sir, hey, fella, garçon, servants, fella, hey. And he would just hurry right on past, because everybody in England is in a hurry to do something big for somebody else who is just around the corner in this restaurant where you are. And he's sitting behind a giant pillar and is obviously some big important lord. And he is on his way to do it for him, whatever it is, and doesn't have time for you. Well, this is much of what I found in England all the time. What? Oh, what about European? I can't understand what you mean. The food in an English plane? It would be cold. What? It would be very cold. Very cold and exceedingly expensive. And it would be a lot less than you thought you were going to get. That would be truly an English plane. Now, there's a lot of myth about the capabilities of how good English food is. Well, let me tell you this, that England is crawling with great French restaurants. Matter of fact, better French restaurants than you find in France. Which is kind of an ironical thing, but very true. It's a very discouraging thing to find that out. And when you talk to an Englishman and you say, take me to a real English restaurant, well, he usually tries to talk you out of it, and you wind up in a Chinese place. And he says, well, this is run by an English friend of mine. Spent a lot of time in Shanghai, you know. And so that becomes the English restaurant. But if you were to get aboard, say, a Dutch plane, you know what happened if you got aboard a Dutch plane and it was Reedy Holland? Now, I'll say this, that of all the airplanes I've ever been aboard, probably the one closest to the way it really is in that country would probably be the Dutch plane. I must say that, that their airplanes are the way pretty much, but not quite. Because if you were to get aboard a Dutch plane and it was really like it is in Holland, the first thing that would hit you, your eyeballs would begin to sweat immediately with the smell of fish. Boy, every place in Holland you smell fish. Because, you know, they're practically underwater. And a lot of fish, from time to time, if you look up quickly, you can see them swimming over. When it's raining hard, the fish just take a shortcut right across, you know, and just go. They don't have to bother to go under or around or however it is they get there now or through the canals. But Holland would be that way. And another thing about Holland as is, or if you go to England, or if you go to Europe and don't go to Holland, forget it. You're missing a great thing. I mean, if there's about a half dozen countries that if I had to give up, if I had to bypass Pittsburgh as a place to die in, there are about a half dozen countries in Europe that I would pick, among them Holland. I dig Holland, and Holland has a quality about it, which is the way you think all of Europe should be before you go to Europe. It's the way you think Europe is, only it ain't. Holland is that way, only in spades. And you get to Holland, and the first thing that hits you is that you better forget it, Dad. You are going to gain 40 pounds just by breathing deep. There's more calories in just the air in Holland than you find in the average meal at Schraft's. And that's one of the big ones, with the dessert, too. They're very interesting people. Now, I'm a boy. Oh, you want to hear about the Italian ship? Well, I get over here. See, the one thing that makes a ship is that ships have remained what they are, because a ship is too big to be a machine. And way down in the basement somewhere is the machine, and all the rest of it is the country, really, literally. And you get aboard the Italian ship, and I'm not aboard there 8 seconds. I'm telling you, I'm walking up the gangplank, and there are 7 Italian seamen in a gigantic argument, and they're trying to clean a lifeboat. I hear a scaroni, and these guys are yelling, and I'm ducking along the railing, you know, hanging on, and by George, I'm right back in Naples. And the argument is going on. I said, for crying out loud, if I'd have known, I'd have just come over here, you know, instead of going all the way over to Italy there to get all that yelling. Immediately on an Italian ship, just as in Italy, you know, you walk around Rome, and there's a peculiar smell. Have you ever wondered about how cities smell? Well, they all have a distinct odor. And they really do. Because of the geographical location, because of the stuff that's made there, because of the kind of stuff the people eat, because of the kind of trees that are there, because of the kind of canaries that fly around in the windowsills, because of millions of things, because of the kind of cars they have. And all of these things gather together to make the amalgam of smell, which is each individual city. And they are not alike. Naples is not like Rome. Holland, for crying out loud, I mean, Amsterdam is nothing like, say, the smell of London. Paris is, again, a unique smell. Paris has a peculiar smell. You know what Paris smells like to me? If you take a book, an old book, and open it, and smell the pages. That's about as close to Paris as I can think of offhand. An old book. Yes. Now, it isn't quite that, but that is as close as I can remember to the way Paris smelled. It smells like an old book. Now, London, on the other hand, well, London has a smell that's very difficult to describe. It is. It's difficult to describe. London smells, I'll tell you, London smells, if you can imagine a closet that has a lot of tennis shoes in it, somehow a closet like this that has been taken far out to sea. Now that's to me the way London smells. It smells, it has a sea old tennis shoe, strange, enclosed, closet-like quality about it. Now, I can't describe it any better than to say that. It's the way London is. Amsterdam, on the other hand. Now, Amsterdam has an intriguing smell. You get into Amsterdam, and you do smell fish, but they're fresh fish. And furthermore, in Amsterdam, that's only part of it. In Amsterdam, for some odd reason, you get the smell of... Do you know the smell? You know what fresh clay mud smells like? Now, if you could smell fresh mud, and it's been somehow mixed with chocolate, it's a very good, odd, earth, warm, it's an engaging smell. I can tell you that I would like to bring a bottle back of Amsterdam air, and you could smell it, and you would immediately feel like somehow you're back at the home office. I don't know how to describe it. It's like somebody's kitchen or something. Yeah. I never can read you through that. If you want to talk to me, put a note up. Yes, I have been there. That's more difficult to describe. Now I can describe. Do you want to hear more of these cities? How they smell? Well, now I've carried away a distinct feeling about every one of these cities, and I have notebooks full of this stuff that I've kept on the smells of cities. This to me is a very intriguing thing. And I'll tell you this: I got aboard that Italian ship. And if you ever get a chance to get aboard the Italian ship, you will smell pretty much the way it smells in northern Italy, not so much in Rome. There is in the air in that area an odd kind of smell. When you're up in Italy, I'm talking about the northern Italy, because they get a wind that comes down over the Alps, and it also carries in over part of the sea and carries through several very old cities. And so when you get up into a city like Milan, you get a smell that is very similar. If you have a sharp nose, and most people don't, I'm afraid, if you have a sharp nose, it smells a great deal like fresh motor oil. Have you ever smelled motor oil? But very fresh motor oil. I'm not talking about old used motor oil. I'm talking about fresh motor oil. But it's highly diluted. And somehow it's motor oil that has been somebody has put into it just a little vanilla or something. There is a quality of vanilla about Rome and about all of Italy. You smell vanilla in the air. It's a vanilla quality. It's just there. And the Middle East now has the beginnings of the great smell of the Orient. Now, I can describe the Orient to you. Nobody seems who has never been there. Most people who haven't been there do not understand immediately when you say smells. They get the wrong idea. This is not true. The Orient has a smell. I remember the first time that I ran into Asia. All of Asia has a distinct odor. It has. And it smells like no other continent. Absolutely. There is no other continent I know of that has a continental odor. Asia does. Africa. Boy, you should ask me about Africa. I'll tell you about how Nigeria smells. Nigeria, especially all of Central Africa. Now, you go to Ghana, you go to Togoland, the Cameroons, you go to that area. And I'm talking about pretty much coastal Africa. West coast of Africa, the Bay of Guinea. The Gulf of Guinea, in that area, down around near the equator, there is a very special smell, which isn't at all the way you probably think it would be. Let me think now. How can I describe it? The smell, it hit me. You better get the smell of a city quick. Be very careful about that. What do you mean? It doesn't smell that way. Well, be very careful before you say that. The question is, do you or are you aware of smells, and do you examine them the way you examine, say, food, or the way you examine the sound of music? Do you examine a smell with the same degree of attention? Well, the minute I hit, the first time I was in Asia, the minute I could smell Asia, like 50 miles out to sea, you begin to smell it. And I'll tell you the closest thing I can say that Asia smells like, and it has a consistency, too. I've been in several places in Asia, and the consistency was there. It was there. The smell of Asia is like, as close as I can think of, is the smell of burnt coffee. Burnt coffee, which somehow has gotten wet, and the coffee has vaguely gotten moldy. But it is distinctly burnt, and it is a distinct herbal smell, herbal with a silent H, as though something has burned that is highly aromatic. And it is a maddening aroma. And once it gets in your clothes, and it's a funny thing, a couple of days ago, I took out a shirt. It was an old Navy type shirt that I had not washed or anything. I had stuck in a bag from 2.5 years ago when I was in the Middle East. And boy, the Middle East has this aroma. And by George, that shirt. Burnt coffee the whole bit. it just sticks with you. You can't get rid of it. Oh, the comment aboard the ship. You want to hear about that? Well, I got aboard the ship, and immediately I smelled Italy in the air, you know. The guys are yelling at each other in the lifeboat, and they're running around. And I was right back home, you know. And I go into the ballroom or stateroom, the big ballroom they had aboard the ship. And it's like everything else in Italy. The chairs are too little. The tables fall over on your knees. This is typical of every place you go in Italy. Everything is vaguely impractical. The statues are too fat. The women are usually fantastic but dumb. everything's slightly out of kilter, you know. And I'm back in the ship, and they're hollering. And the captain shows up, and he's got a sort of a wild-eyed look, you know. As though he's afraid any minute now the bottom is going to come out of the thing, and she's going to go to the bottom of the river there. And he sort of looks around, and they're demonstrating the costumes that Elizabeth Taylor. You never saw such a pile of sequins and junk in your life. Oy, 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 ancient. I can imagine poor old ancient Egypt like this. Oh, no wonder they fell. Well, this line set the tenor of it all. There was some girl with a heavy Bronx accent who was narrating. She says, "And now I'd like to show you the beautiful costume that was worn when Octavio told Elizabeth Taylor that she was to rule Egypt. Now this was the gown that was worn in the scene when Caesar came and told Elizabeth Taylor that they were going to have a war with Rome. Now, Elizabeth Taylor, in the next scene, when Elizabeth Taylor was about to feed the Christians to the lions, this is a scene that Elizabeth Taylor wore when she ruled all of Egypt." And I'm sitting there, and my head is spinning slightly, and I can hear outside of the window, "Scongiungli, madonna!" Guys are yelling and hollering, and the table is falling over on my knees, and Elizabeth Taylor is ruling all of Egypt. All of Egypt. This week, remember, friends, Otto Preminger is crossing the Alps, maybe this very minute, from Vienna to Rome to continue filming The Cardinal. And Elizabeth Taylor ruled all of Egypt.